From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
This episode of Fragmented is brought to you by BuddyBuild.
A key component to building a successful software is, well, of course, engaging end users throughout the entire development process. Now, BuddyBuild is a mobile-optimized continuous integration and delivery platform that was built specifically to help developers engage their end users. Thousands of mobile development teams already love BuddyBuild because it's one of the fastest ways to build, run tests, and distribute Android and iOS applications to their users. Using BuddyBuild's SDK, you can gather feedback, crash reports, and important device metadata from users in real time. You can then use these cool special built-in integrations that BuddyBuild has for various different bug trackers and, you know, chat tools like Slack to seamlessly integrate that same data back into your development process so you can get notified whenever is convenient. BuddyBuild also provides developers with the perfect insight into certain bugs and helps enable you to help iterate faster on your application than ever. In the end, they're trying to make sure that you're building an app that you know your users will love. Join thousands of developers who've already added BuddyBuild to their development process. Try it free today at fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild. Again, that's fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild. Thanks again, BuddyBuild. This week on Fragmented, I'm at DroidCon NYC 2017. Unfortunately, Kaushik wasn't able to make it with me. However, I was able to sit down with a bunch of individuals and discuss all different types of things around mobile development, including topics around Kotlin, React Native, design patterns, Android security, and more. Trust me, this is a great episode. We talked to a bunch of great individuals from the community. Let's get right to it. All right, so we're here at DroidCon NYC 2017. I'm sitting here with Dan Kinn from Basecamp. Dan, you're here and you're actually a speaker here. What are you giving a talk on today?
I'm giving a talk on getting to 100% Kotlin. So at Basecamp, we've been fortunate enough to get to 100% Kotlin in our app. So I'm going to give some strategies and tips and stuff that people can do if they're wanting to do that as well.
So did you start your application with Kotlin, or was it a rewrite, or did you slowly introduce Kotlin, or what did that look like from the Basecamp perspective?
Yep. Just like everybody else, we had a pure Java app for a long while. And when Kotlin hit 1.0 around then, we decided like it was worth a try. And so we basically very slowly started moving stuff over. We didn't do anything too crazy or too big up front. We just kind of did small conversions and get our feet wet. And we're basically trying to learn the language, but continue to ship features. And also we had to sort of convert a big backlog of existing code as well. So that's kind of what my talk is about. It's about how to do that in a timely but efficient way and do it in a way that's not stressful and still allows you to ship real work, right? Like, we weren't going to go off to some boot camp for 3 months and learn the language and come back and try to do it. Like, we had to do this during our day job. We weren't going to spend our nights and weekends just learning Kotlin. So, we kind of just went slowly, took our time, and just kind of migrated over. I think the number was 430 days. And our app was pretty moderately sized, and we have a small team. And so the best thing you can do is just kind of just take your time and just let it go slowly.
I know in some of the projects that I've worked on, we had a ton of Java, of course, but then we wanted to move it over to Kotlin. And there's been some choices that were made. Say, all right, we're not going to move a particular file until we touch it. And there could be those times when you may have that help screen or that about screen that never really changes, right? How did you manage those types of scenarios? Or did you guys have like a better plan to say, all right, well, we're going to go attack these like less touch screens or these less touch features because we want to get to 100% Kotlin? Or what did you guys do in those situations?
Yep. I think toward the end when we were tasting 100%, we were very close to that, then we would consider like, okay, let's just go do it just for the sake of doing it. But it certainly wasn't like the thing that we hit up front. We started slowly and did things like models and adapters and utility functions and things like that. And then slowly worked our way up to, our presenters and our activities and stuff like that. And then at the end, you just sort of finish up everything else. We just felt like that number would be fun to hit. And so we did do those. But I think it's also important not to get too caught up in that 100% number. I think it is a nice talking point. It I'm very happy that I get to work in 100% Kotlin, you know, all the time. But it's also important not to get hung up on that, right? Like, if you're, if the majority of your work is in like 60% of these classes, and thus that stuff is in Kotlin, and the other 40% you never touch, like, who cares, right? It's just this number. It's a nice talking point. So really what you're shooting for is that the majority of your stuff, if you, you know, you're really into Kotlin, the majority of your stuff is in Kotlin, the stuff you work with day to day.
I'm sure that you encountered some weird things when you're moving over from Java. Do you remember any of the weird situations that you did encounter, or maybe a really difficult situation transitioning from, you know, Java to purely Kotlin?
Yeah, for us, we definitely had some moments where things were just kind of ugly and just felt bad, like felt wrong. And I think it's important to know that pretty much any team that's going to do a large scale transition to Kotlin is going to have that moment. It's just like weird, uncanny valley stuff you're just like not super happy with. And we definitely had that. One thing that we had happen was that we have base classes for our activities and for our presenters. And for a long time, we had them all in Java. And then as we started moving over, we had another subset of those that were baked in Kotlin. So we basically had duplicate base classes for a while. And it was horrible. Like, it was not our finest moment of stuff. But, and we could have, you know, pointed our Java stuff over to Kotlin, but we were doing some other stuff and experimenting. We wanted to keep it isolated and safe. So there was good reason for it, but, like, that was not our finest moment. Like, we had duplicate code all over the place. So, you know, just to sort of reaffirm to people that, like, hey, you're going to have these moments where, you know, we did it and everybody's going to go through this awkward phase where the code's just like not where it is. You might have like hacks to work around a library that's not working or something just odd, and everybody's going to go through it. So I think it's good to remember that we've all gone through that weird, awkward phase.
I think that's important because, as you said, you get to those weird situations where you have these two base classes. You have duplicated code, most likely, in some places. It feels dirty. It's a bad code smell. It's against all conventional wisdom that we've been taught. So it's good to actually say, hey, this is actually a professional team that's gone through this and see it, so people know that they're not alone. Like, all right, this is something normal in a transitional period.
Especially when you're learning, when you're working with a new language, right? Yeah. This isn't like just implementing a library or something like that. Like, this is a whole language change. So yes, it's very close to Java and the compat is very good, but it's a significant thing. So you're going to see probably weirder things than you would just sort of implementing a library or a new architecture or something like that. Like, this is pretty fundamental. So, you know, don't stress about it. It's going to happen.
Now, there's something else I want to talk to you about. Is that you share a very common goal that I also have, and that's developer happiness. And actually, where you work at Basecamp, you know, DHH, for those who aren't familiar, David Hannemeyer Hansen, the creator of Rails, you know, is, I think he's a CTO, right? Is that the Basecamp? And he's very passionate about developer happiness and productivity and so forth. And I feel the exact same way. And ever since working with Kotlin, I came from a web background. And so I was, in the languages I was using then, I was very happy. And then I came to Java and I got very sad. And I stayed sad, kind of with this like smiley face, like the sad clown kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? But then when Kotlin came along, I felt very happy. And then you wrote a blog post that was something around developer happiness. What makes Kotlin, you know, that type of environment for you? Is it something that you think matters to be happy in your development language, or how do you feel about that?
I mean, developer happiness to me is crucial to the creation, I think, of any good product or team or whatever it is you're working on. Like, being happy as a programmer means you're going to perform better and you're going to just do better work, right? And Kotlin for me did that on a couple different levels, but basically it was just so concise and readable, and it had all these conveniences built in that were just, you know, you could do them in Java. It just wasn't as easy. And so because it was easier, as a result, I felt like my work was better. And so basically my life is easier. My work is better. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to be happier because of it. And that's because of the language change. It's just Java. I just never felt that way because I didn't ever have experiences like that where I felt like my work was improving. And because of a simple change, like, or a significant change, but a change. And so that's what made me happy. It was like, hey, my work is better. Life is easier. Like, this is beautiful and wonderful, and I get it. Yeah, so I think that's super important. And for anybody interested in Kotlin, obviously it's a subjective thing. Not yes. Everybody's going to feel that. Not everybody's going to be impressed or happy from a programming language. But I guess the story is that, you know, it can happen, and, you know, you can find quote unquote happiness from a programming language.
Well, Dan, thanks for taking the time here at DroidCon NYC 2017. Talk to me. If folks want to get a hold of you, what's the best way that they can get a hold of you?
I'm on Twitter, at Dan Kim. And then if you want to shoot me an email, dan@basecamp.com. Thank you.
Anyway, we're here at the DroidCon 2017 live. I'm talking to Gabriel Peel. Gabriel, you're a speaker today at the conference. Is that right?
That is correct.
What are you talking on?
Today I'm going to talk about Lottie. We're going to show what the community has done with it, and then also take a deep dive into some of the Android APIs that are used to actually build it.
Fantastic. So for folks that are not familiar, Lottie is what?
Lottie is a library that takes animations that were built with Adobe After Effects, exports them as JSON, and then renders them natively on Android.
Oh, okay. So it makes sense to me, and the reason why I say that is because we've already interviewed you here on the Fragmented Podcast. So if folks are interested, please check the show notes to the show, and you can check out the full episode. So I'm actually going to detour this entire conversation away from Lottie and talk to something me and you talked about earlier today, and that's my interest, actually, in React Native. And as you were talking, you actually do quite a bit of React Native, and from what I understand, you've been doing it for a while now. Is that correct? Can you give me a little bit of history on your experience with React Native, how long you've been doing it, and so forth?
Yeah, so me personally, I started doing React Native in January 2017. But as a company at Airbnb, we first started investing in it about 18 months ago, sort of around the middle of 2016-ish. And the goal was we had a lot of web developers and a lot of need to build more quickly on mobile. And we just couldn't scale our mobile teams quickly enough. And React Native came along as a potential technology that would allow us to pick up our velocity a little bit and ship high-quality products that are performant and beautiful with animations, but at a faster pace than we were able to ship before.
So are you using... Is it live in the application now?
Yeah. So as of today, like towards the end of 2017, we have actually almost 200 screens in the app that are React Native.
How many screens do you have?
You know, it's a little bit harder to count the native ones. I don't actually have the number on the top of my head, but it's about, as far as lines of code, it's about 20% of our code base right now.
Wow, okay. That's super interesting. So one of the things that I asked you earlier, which I think is interesting too, is I'm wondering, you know, about the native controls. Everyone says, yeah, these are real native buttons. You said it is. It's rendered onto native. And you showed me a screen that was actually had a picture on it and some, you know, some calendars, and it flowed very fluidly. I wouldn't have been able to tell if you just gave it to me. I would have thought it was an Android app. I didn't know it was React Native. And then the question I had for you was, all right, well, what about your design? Do you do everything material? And then you had an interesting answer to that. I wonder if you could kind of repeat what you said to me in there about kind of the components you guys have kind of designed or whatever.
Yeah, so we spent a long time building a design component library for all of our mobile apps and actually our desktop website as well. We call it DLS. It stands for Design Language System. But it's a set of about 50 core components that includes rows and buttons and switches and things like that. But while we designed it, we were very intentional to make sure that it both felt like Airbnb, but it also didn't feel just like iOS or just like Android, because then it would not feel at home in the other platform. So for the most part, it's a new design language that's very Airbnb catered, but we've made specific platform differences for Android or iOS where appropriate. So things like a row that has a disclosure chevron on iOS won't have it on Android because that's not a common pattern on Android. Or the things like the navigation bar on iOS or the toolbar on Android totally use the native components with stock icons, the material design icons like for sharing, back, like saving to a wish list and things like that, so that users will recognize it as Airbnb, but they'll feel right at home with the platform.
So it won't feel like it's like I'm running in a web view or anything like that.
Exactly. And then that's the other part about React Native is that although it is a JavaScript framework, cross-platform framework, which is sort of, may have a bad reputation, but just by default among the mobile community. But at the end of the day, what it's actually doing is rendering, it's doing the layout actually in C++. It's super fast. It uses a library from Facebook called Yoga, which they use for Facebook components for Android, Litho, and a variety of other things. And so it does a super fast layout with C++, and then it spits out normal Android views, the exact same views with ripples and toggles and switches that you would use.
This is the framework that does that, the Yoga thing?
Yeah, exactly. So this is just React Native out of the box. There's the way it was designed. Just spits out normal Android views. There's absolutely no difference. It's a little bit different than something like Flutter, where they try to sort of recreate the UI framework. And then you can build bridges for anything you want. So we at Airbnb, we have our, which is a very common thing, we have our, like, our custom text view and our custom image view, custom networking layers, and all, a bunch of custom parts of our native stack. And we've just built these bridges into React Native. And so with a common API on the JavaScript side, it actually ties into all of the deep architecture and foundation that we've already built into our native app.
That's cool. I think that's one of the big things that I'm seeing here with React Native is all this sharing that you can have. And one of the things I'm seeing multiple teams doing at different clients of mine is building this kind of this component library of like, all right, this is what our button's going to look like. And it looks like that on iOS and it looks like that on Android. And of course, there's little differences, like you said, the ripple and so forth. But one of the things that has always kind of made me worried about React Native was it evolves so quickly. I've seen a lot of reports out there that folks who were built on it a few versions ago, upgrading is a really tedious task. Have you found that to be a similar case for you?
So it can be a little bit hit or miss upgrading React Native versions. I think recently there was a particularly difficult upgrade which bundled in the upgrade from React 15.4 to React 16 Alpha, which caused some issues with versioning and libraries and stuff like that. I think going forward, Facebook sort of recognizes some of the pain that this particular upgrade caused. And so going forward, hopefully it's a little bit smoother. Generally, the actual framework itself is relatively stable, and so we actually didn't have too many issues with actual incompatibilities with our own code or breaking changes. There were just some version mismatches, and getting NPM to properly resolve some dependencies with the new React version was a little bit of a pain with the most recent upgrade, but if anyone from Facebook is listening, please don't do that again. But
well, that's cool. The question I have for you is you worked at Google, you've worked deep into Android, you've done Android at Airbnb, you've kind of been all over the ecosystem, and now you're doing React Native a lot. What is your like gut feeling on React Native? How do you feel about it? Is it like, hey, this is cool, this looks like the future, or is it like kind of iffy? Are we looking at the tip of the iceberg or what?
So I think one of the things I'm constantly thinking about in my head is that, you know, we're engineers by profession, and that one of the things that we do is we like to figure out pros and cons and be quite pragmatic with how we choose technologies. And I think that React Native in particular is a really interesting technology because it has really strong pros and some actual downsides. And it's important for any project to sort of consider what are the pros and what are the cons and weigh that and figure out how it balances into the needs of your own project. So, you know, some of the things that are more difficult with React Native today are infinitely scrolling lists. The maintainability of code is a little bit harder because it is JavaScript, and with things like TypeScript or Flow and ESLint and better tooling from VS Code and a variety of other things in the industry, it's starting to get better, but it's no match for some of the things you might get with Kotlin and IntelliJ that are just extremely powerful, and IntelliJ just knows a lot about your code inherently because of the language. And so it can be difficult in that regards, but at the same time, when you watch a product developer sit down, write React with Redux and using some other tools from the JavaScript community, and then they hit save, and then it shows up on Android and iOS 1 second later, like literally 1 second later, it's times like that make me take a step back and think, wow, like this is the future. Like, why are we writing things twice, once for Android, one for iOS, when if we just build the right underlying infrastructure to allow product engineers to just build a product once, which is totally possible. It's really a magical developer experience.
You said something earlier that really piqued my interest, and I kind of agreed with. I was talking about a recent friend of mine who went to a different company, and they're having some challenges with React Native, and they wanted to kind of replace some of the underlying core architecture with something a little more robust. Maybe it was native, maybe it was something else. And you said that you felt, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you need to have a strong engineering effort on the architecture. Can you explain why that is, or what your thought process is there?
So, and I was also, I had multiple conversations today about just how, as these our mobile apps have gotten enormously more complex over the last few years, they keep growing in size. They have hundreds of thousands, in some cases, literally millions of lines of code in an app. And I think people outside of mobile would be blown away to see how much, what they interact with is just the tip of the iceberg. it really is just the tip. And there's so much architecture underneath to handle things like authentication and internationalization and right to left support. There are a million things you could go down the list that are required to really have a robust and complex, fully featured app. And the same is true when you're integrating React Native. And if you try to just slap it as a layer on top, you're going to have a bad experience. I'd say if that's the approach, it's not even worth it to try. Because it really, in order to get a good experience, you really have to deeply integrate it. You have to build those bridges into all of your existing native infrastructure. You have to figure out how to tie APIs between Android and iOS such that you have a seamless experience from the JavaScript side. And so from the beginning, at least at Airbnb, we've had multiple people working full-time purely on keeping the React Native infrastructure sound and tying it into all the new native infrastructure that we're building so that it really does feel seamless. I mean, we've even gotten as far as having shared element transitions between native and React Native screens fully. And it's a really simple API on the JavaScript side. You just wrap whatever views you want with a shared element tag. Just like it's a React component, and then all of its children will be a shared element, and then it'll recognize if it's an image and do the scale, the matrix transformation that you would normally get between two native screens. And then we built the same thing on iOS as well, the same API. And so shared element transitions you get on both platforms for free, but it takes work to get there, right? We had to put in a fair amount of work up front in order to build that on both platforms. But then once you've done that, you wind up with an experience that is just unparalleled on either platform alone.
Hearing the whole 1 second thing, rewinding that a few seconds ago, that literally blows my mind. Hearing like the shared element transitions, hearing everything else in that area makes me super pumped. Want to go try it like right now. For folks that are just getting started with React Native, what would you recommend? You know, a couple of tips recommend to them get going in their free web. What would you recommend?
So that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people who start working on React Native come from the React side, and then they try to learn mobile as they go. I think if you're listening to this podcast, you're one of the rare breeds that are maybe considering going the other direction. And so you actually have some mobile experience, and you're trying to get into React and React Native. And so actually building a React screen is a React Native screen is actually quite similar to a React screen. In fact, you can use a lot of the same NPM libraries, NPM packages that you would use if you were building a website. So I would start with just React tutorials, like get familiar with some of the new JavaScript conventions. So if you've been in the Android world for a couple of years and maybe done JavaScript like 3-4 years ago, I think you may actually be pleasantly surprised at some of the things that have come along in the last couple of years between ES6, TypeScript. ESLint is an incredibly powerful linting tool that can actually catch a surprising number of things. You can have basically statically typed props for your React components. And there's a variety of things that you can do to actually have quite a pleasant developer experience in JavaScript, which was not the case just a couple of years ago. And so to familiarize yourself with some of these new things that have come along in the JavaScript world, as well as React and understanding components and props and state and just React stuff, you know.
Well, great. Gabriel, thank you for taking the time here at the DroidCon 2017. If folks would like to get a hold of you, what's the best way that they can do that?
So you can always reach me on Twitter. My handle is GPEAL8, GPEAL8. If you reach me there, send me a message or something, I'll definitely respond. But thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks again, Gabriel.
See ya.
I'm here with Scott Alexander Bown. So it's the first time we've met. Welcome here to DroidCon, Scott.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks, Don. Thanks for having me.
So from what I hear, everyone I've talked to about Android security, anytime I ask a question about it, I say, who can I talk to? Usually I get pointed in your direction. So I wanted to sit down with you for a few minutes and talk about Android security and kind of what that means at a high level. So I guess when folks usually come to you for Android security advice or consulting or whatever it is, what does that usually entail? Are they talking about the actual getting down to the low level of Android, or are they talking about securing their application, or what does it kind of entail end to end?
I think mainly it's around what can they do in their apps to make it more secure. I think there's a lot of security is such a huge, multifaceted sort of field. And your app is like just one part of that. And so there's a lot of considerations from the server side down to, your app. And I think there's lots of things you can do generally, I think that security is one of those things which isn't prioritized. You know, a lot of times we're looking at user interactions, animations and stuff like that, and not actually the security side of things. So I think that's because there's a perception it's going to add lots of time to development and things. But I think there's a lot of there's the kind of perception that you can't trust the client, you can't trust the environment that your app runs on. So there's almost a sense of like, why bother doing any security? Because, you know, ultimately there's only so many things you can do. But my kind of approach or my advice is really that there's a lot of things you can do to make it more difficult for adversaries, for attackers. And there's a lot of stuff you can do just to up the bar that doesn't actually require that much like development effort. And things that aren't actually that hard. A lot of the talks that I've done when I spoke about improving security is stuff that, you know, everyday developers, you don't have to be a security expert. The talk I did today at DroidCon was specifically aimed at developers and not security experts. It's just things that you can do to, you know, remove the low-hanging fruit, really, and, you know, to do security better than say, your competition, you know, increase the time and the skill level required to attack your app. And I think that's the key thing. You can't make it 100% secure, and in some respects you should accept that going into it, but you can definitely improve the security to the point where it's you want to make it economically unfeasible. That's the kind of the goal in security, and there's stuff you can do to make that possible.
So if I'm listening to this and I want to improve the security of my application, or even to spin this a completely different way, let's say you've consulted for a while now and you've brought into a company, and the company says, hey, we want to, you know, give our app a security audit to figure out what's going on. What would you say like some of the most common problems that you've seen, or the commonest like attack vectors that are wide open in apps that you've seen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it varies a lot, you know, from some apps that maybe do encryption, but then the developers have accidentally left in, you know, log statements that log out like critical things that are part of that process. To, you know, when apps are talking to servers and don't do like proper SSL sort of validation and stuff, and the platform by default will do a lot of that stuff for you, but they've had to work around things like, you know, using say self-signed certificates for development, and then they've left that code in their apps and in production, and that can, you know, kind of defeats the object of having SSL at all. So there's things like that. There's also like things like having maybe using encryption but having a hard-coded key in each app, and you know, really you should probably think about your source code as being open source, even though it's closed, you know,
as soon as it gets out in the world, it's you consider it as open source.
Yeah, I think even if you're using obfuscation, if you're using ProGuard and stuff, it's still, you know, it ups the level, like, you know, it's a low hanging fruit like to use obfuscation, and using some of the paid commercial tools raise that even further. But generally, yeah, you should sort of treat it as being open source. So if you've hidden, or you think you've hidden a secret within the app, a hard-coded secret, it's not hidden at all. So that's like a classic vulnerability I see when someone has used you know, standard sort of Java crypto, you know, reasonably strong, but then have used like a hard-coded key, that there's really, you haven't really added any security to that aspect. You know, it's very easy to sort of reverse engineer, find that. And then the problem is that if you've just done it in one app, then you could, once you've got that key, if you've just got the one, then you could easily decrypt data on other devices and things. So like one of the things you can do to sort of make that better is like generating a key per device. I mean, even if that's stored in like the shared preferences, which isn't, which is shared, you know, sandboxed on a normal device, on a rooted device.
It's wide open, I believe, or something.
Yeah, so on a rooted device, a root process or an app with root privileges could access that. So you haven't got that sort of integrity. But at least if it ups the skill level, you needed to have a compromised device. And then at least, say, if the key is then compromised, the key is only compromised for that one installation, because you've generated that key for that installation. It's not like a shared secret between lots of apps. So things like that. It's thinking about that. So if you've got a shared secret, it's shared, and it's definitely not a secret.
So if I had like a, let's say I my team built an API, that API needs some type of token to access that API. Traditionally, and I've been guilty of this early on in my career, I would take that token and I'd put it in a constant somewhere in some file. And you're telling me now that that's going to be one of those vectors where they could decompile the app and take a look, say, hey, here's that key, and it's been installed on a million devices through this app. Now I can just use this key and just start, you know, attacking this API or whatever.
So that's a good point. Yeah, API keys are always, it's like a difficult one because the you need something in there and you need to have it like static. So you mean you can use commercial tools like DexGuard has a way of encrypting the files, so you could put it in one of theirs using string encryption. That again ups the skill level required to sort of get to that. But things like using OAuth, where you've got like a challenge response, where you give the app a token and it uses that for the sessions and things like that, rather than having like a fixed one.
So something almost like expires. So in that case, like, or even it comes from the server. I've implemented a very similar thing like that. Once you log in, then okay, we're going to send you down your keys. We store them in memory or something like that, and then your session expires, the memory expires or whatever, gets cleaned out.
Stuff like that. Yeah, and the key thing with that is using that kind of that methodology, I guess, where you've got like this active token, like a session, effectively. Yeah. And if you run sort of tools like the safety net attestation test or some of the other kind of tests that you can do as part of in the safety net API, you know, your server can then find out, you know, is this a trusted device? You know, safety net attestation is a really good one to sort of put in, and it's a good one that does it's not billed as like a root checking service, but that it does that as part of it. So you could do that, run it on your server. You kind of run it on the device and you pass the result to your server for verification. And that's where you could use something like that to revoke the tokens and stuff. So if your server then know that this device is compromised, it's rooted or has, you know, an active API attack on, which you can do with SafetyNet, you know, your server could revoke the tokens for that session. So, yes.
Cool. Excellent. So if we were to... if you were to tell a developer or a team, you kind of walked in there and maybe you're teaching a class or something like that, and you said, hey, here's a couple of tips. These are the top tips I would tell you about when you're developing your app, just to be aware of. And for the folks listening, what would you tell them? Like, hey, look out for these couple of things to make your app a little more secure, or here's a few things you should look into.
Yeah, so I would definitely say look at the SafetyNet sort of package of the Google Play services. There's a couple of APIs in that now which can help, and it's all free to use. Obviously, that assumes that you're in the Google Play environment. But yeah, definitely say look at that. Look at the network security config, which is an API, a way of hardening your network kind of connections, which came out in Android N. There's a backport of that Mark Murphy developed, which is backports that config all the way back to sort of Android 4.2. Wow. So that's really like cool sort of thing to sort of improve, harden your network connections and, you know, your communication between your app and the server. So those are probably the two main ones I would say to look at.
Well, Scott, I don't want to take any more of your time. Thank you for speaking for a few minutes here at DroidCon 2017 in New York City. If folks want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah, just on Twitter, really, ScottyAB. That's the best way.
Well, thanks again, and have a good rest of the conference.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
I am sitting here with Jose Altherica from Google. Jose, you're a speaker here, and you and I met actually online through a Slack group last year when you wanted to talk to me about some Android architecture samples. I think they might have been called something even differently back then, but we were kind of chatting back and forth. So I want to talk to you a little bit about some of these things and what they are. So just kind of give a real quick round trip here. It is a project on GitHub. It has, I think you told me earlier, over 20,000 stars. So it's fairly popular, but there are people all over the world that listen to the podcast that probably have never heard about this GitHub repository and what it holds. So I was wondering if you could give us a rundown of what it holds, what it is, and why developers might find it important.
Sure. So I started working with Stefan Linsner on testing, and we realized that you basically needed a good architecture in order to test. That was like mandatory. So we did this Android testing code lab. And we decided to use an MVP architecture. Okay. So from there, this project just was obvious because we were deciding to use MVP, but there were so many patterns out there and we wanted to experiment because there's no good, really fit for all architecture. So we decided to create this new repo with, you know, using the same app, but in different using different patterns or different libraries or different architectural tools. So that's the idea behind it.
Okay. So you said something important there that I think is it, most people kind of gloss over this topic, is that you are using the, is it the same app concept?
Yeah, exactly the same app. So the UI tests are actually the same. So the UI is exactly the same experience. But what changes is, you know, the backend, let's say, of the architecture of each branch. We create a different branch per project, let's say.
Okay, so I this is the first time I've ever heard this. So that's phenomenal to me, because one of the things that I'm a big advocate of is if you're teaching a concept to folks, is that you want as few mental context switches as possible. So if you're able to keep that same app, and in my opinion, if I see you make an app with MVP, and then you say, okay, now we're going to take this same to-do app. Now I have no idea what the app is, but if it's a to-do app. So, okay, we take this to-do app, it's built in MVP, and like, okay, we're going to do the same exact app in MVVM, and what would that look like? Now, I already know what each screen's looking like. I know what the input fields, the buttons, and everything, and so I no longer have to focus on, okay, why is this button over here? I can just say, okay, how is the underlying architecture changing underneath? And is that kind of what these templates and blueprints show? And then?
Yeah, not just that. We also focus on architectural tools. So, for example, if you want to see how to integrate Dagger into your MVP architecture, then you can just compare branches. So we have an MVP Dagger branch. Oh. So you can use something like Meld and compare the actual directory. So you can see each file, how it changes. So you can see very, very clearly what you need to go from point A to point B.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So how many patterns do you have currently in that repository? Do you have any clue? Or is there a ton, or is there just a few, or what?
It's something like 7 currently. We decided to deprecate 3 of them because maintenance is an absolute pain because, you know, so many branches. Each time there's a UI bug or bug fix, I have to merge it to every single branch. And yeah, we decided to start deprecating branches, only the, let's say, the old ones, or, you know, like loaders, the content providers one, and the data binding with MVP. Those are deprecated. But then we have, we're focusing now on MVVM. Okay. We've explored MVP last year, let's say. So yeah, and now we are, we have, 3 or 4 developer branches or branches in development, including the architecture components ones. We're waiting for them to be stable.
Okay. So is this something that just Google builds internally and then kind of pushes out? I know some projects are like that, that they push them out to public when they're ready to be out to public after they've gone through legal or whatever. Is this something that's like that at Google, or does the community have any involvement, or what?
Not at all. It's actually completely different from the rest of our samples because we wanted the community to be part of it. So it's like a real open source project, and the community and actually bringing the community to the project allowed us to talk about things like RxJava for the first time. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think we have the authority to create a sample about RxJava.
Yeah.
But if someone from the community does it, then we will definitely have the space and you know, and we will give it the attention it deserves. But, you know, it's not made by Google directly.
Okay, so that's cool then. So then if I wanted to go, if I saw this MVVM example and maybe I feel very strongly about something you're doing that could be done differently, I could then maybe create a pull request, send it up there and kind of get some feedback on it?
Absolutely. I mean, the issues tab in the repo is basically a huge forum. Okay. Of opinions and discussions. It's super interesting. Actually, I would like to have something better because, you know, issues on GitHub are limiting. But it's really interesting. So everything starts in an issue. Okay. And sometimes it grows into a PR, but yeah.
Okay, interesting. Now, if someone is interested in this, for example, a lot, architecture is huge. Even at this conference here, you walk to the different rooms and anyone who's talking about any type of architecture, the room is just packed. So everyone, it's a really hot topic right now. If someone wants to go pick up MVVM, say, for example, or MVP, and they went to this repository, should they treat this app as a starter app, or should they treat it as reference, or how could they kind of get going on to apply these principles that they're learning in these samples to their own applications?
Definitely reference. We didn't want to provide templates. Okay. This is something that you use to learn specific patterns or learn about specific patterns or learn about specific tools. That's why we don't have a large combination of tools. Like, we don't have MVVM with RxJava, with Dagger, with content providers. You know, we have an MVP with RxJava and an MVVM with RxJava, but not the combination of, you know, with Dagger, with content providers, etc. So it's definitely, we don't want to become the template repository for Android.
Interesting. So this is all super interesting. If someone has their own idea of a pattern, like, for example, like I've talked about this in a recent podcast, Hans Dorfman, who's one of the co-hosts of the Context podcast, he has authored a couple of blog posts about MVI, model view intent. So if they wanted to bring in an MVI example, I have no idea if you have one, if you do, but if they wanted to, could, again, they just submit another PR and bring that up, or what?
He's actually doing it.
Oh, I see. I didn't even know.
Yeah. With Benoit and David Gonzalez, they're working on an MVI pattern right now, or MVI sample. Not sure if it's going to be part of the official list of samples, but we have something in the main README, in the main list of branches, we have external samples. Oh. And that's very interesting because, you know, if you have for example, we have a sample for the Conductor library. It's not big enough to be one of the seven main, you know, samples, but it's interesting enough. So we have this external samples list, and it points to the, you know, the developer's repository, like their own repositories. And that's great. It works really, really great. It doesn't have to be up to date because, you know, we don't guarantee that it's going to be, but, you know, it's great for those, like, more obscure patterns that are not that popular. But in the future, if they get a lot of attention, definitely we would be happy to include it to the official list.
This has been a fantastic talk. Quick little introduction about what you're hosting up here on, and it's up on GitHub. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. We'll make sure that the link is in the show notes. I'm excited to go check out some of these things. I didn't know that you guys even had these external sources, so I'm learning a ton today. I know you're a really busy man, so thanks for taking the time here at DroidCon NYC 2017. If folks want to get a hold of you, what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
So my Twitter handle is PPVI, but if you want to, you know, discuss architecture, the repo on Google Samples is a great way to start a discussion.
Well, thanks again, Jose. Have a great rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Kevin Galligan. Kevin, you are the organizer of DroidCon NYC, as well as the founder of TouchLab. So can you tell us a little bit about TouchLab and DroidCon and kind of how it got started and a little bit of history about it?
Sure. So back in actually 2008, I was doing Android development as kind of a hobby. It was before the G1. They had a contest. Google had a contest that you can only run in an emulator. And I entered for no reason. I think there were like 50 people in the world that entered. And so I had Android experience, and I figured Android would never do anything, honestly. And then right around 2010, I haven't had a real job in about a decade. So around 2010, there was our first client, Squarespace. They were just looking for an Android developer. Nobody in New York could do Android. So I went in and we got that contract, and then we got another contract, and then found, hired somebody, and then hired a couple more people, and then just kind of spun it up. So Android, it was Android only, really up until about a year ago. Okay. And that was kind of our pitch. And then, Jeff, my business partner, came along. I was a client of his 'cause he was helping with the marketing. I'm very good with the developing. and that's it, right? So like he was helping us sell, and then yeah, and then we also run the big Android meetup and all that kind of stuff. So
okay, so how did you get started with DroidCon NYC? What kicked that whole thing off?
How long has it been going? So DroidCon NYC, the first one was 2014, and at the time, it's odd. There was this other entity called Nivoda that exists in London, also in Berlin and some other places. And it was also run by a guy named Kevin, and they also ran a big meetup. And they ran DroidCon. I had never been to one. And then I heard they were like going to come to New York and start a meetup and be the Android shop and run it. And we're like, wait a second. So, yeah. So we reached out to, I don't know. It was like, hey, why don't we run a conference? And it's just not something you normally think about. But then we reached out to Boris, and then we worked out a deal. And then all of a sudden, I wrote a check for the deposit. And then I hadn't seen the space, and I saw the space. And I'm like, wow, we're going to go out of business. But then, it worked out. And frankly, it was interesting because we first put it out there. I didn't think anybody was going to, we were getting a couple applications to speak. It wasn't anything to speak of, really. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of snowballed. So we had a really good lineup the first year. And sponsors came in. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing. It's crazy how it worked out. And if you had asked me beforehand, I would have been like, oh, that's a horrible idea. That's not going to happen. I don't know why we did it, but we did it. So here we are.
And here you are. So what's 2017? How many have you done now?
This is the fourth. Okay. This is the fourth New York. We also were involved in SF, but like somewhat financially as well. Okay. Although there was kind of a split partnership. And then we've helped out with some other ones like Montreal. But yeah, this is our fourth New York, so it's kind of my fifth conference.
Cool. So I can tell from your face that you're excited to do another one. You're going to start tomorrow, right?
Every year, it's funny because I think people are like, yeah, okay, enough. Every year, it's like, I'm not doing this again. Every year. And then it's amazing. A couple months after, then you're kind of like, people start asking and then you start making plans. So I don't know.
I always gotta ask.
Yeah. So I don't know. There's gonna be another one. What our involvement's gonna be is sort of interesting. We had sort of a different year this year. Like we as a company decided to have a different deal with DroidCon because DroidCon's taken a bunch of investment with a much bigger partner in Berlin. So we didn't actually do the money for this one. We were worried about we were in charge of the content. And this is what happened in London. And Nivoda kind of stepped back, actually, because they had a change of focus of their business, which is kind of a little bit of what we were doing. So we'll see. I like doing it. But it's also very time consuming. And yeah. It's interesting because we had Tanya, who now works for DroidCon Global, who is logistically managing the DroidCons. And she used to work for us. And, so it depends. If they're going to run it, if we can find a good community of, a good group of community members to really be the content filters and stuff like that, I don't know that we need to. We would be involved, but maybe not as directly as we are. We'll see how it goes. Or it'll be a year from now, and I'll be saying the same thing. Like I can't tell you right now. I have no idea.
All right, cool. One of the interesting things here is that most conferences I go to, the organizer usually doesn't speak, but you're actually a speaker here today, and you just got done speaking a few moments ago. And it's actually a very interesting topic that you've kind of showed me over the last year or so of something you've been working on. Would you mind telling folks what you're working on, what it's called, and kind of why they might find it interesting?
Sure. I would open with, I started my talk with the rule that I have, which is don't speak at your own conference. For a number of reasons. First of all, since you control the content, it doesn't really count, right? Like, of course I got to talk. But also because you never have time. You always think you will and you don't. Okay. So what we're working on is called Doppel. And Doppel is, it's Android centric code sharing is how we describe it. We don't say cross platform because that's like a negative term. Mm-hmm. If anybody has used cross platform stuff. It is a productization of J2OBJC, which is built by Google, which makes Java to Objective-C.
So I can write Java and it turns it into Objective-C.
You got it. what we've added on top of that is a, you know, a usable build tool, in this case Gradle, which they don't really have a build tool. They have examples with make files and all this stuff, anything but Gradle. They just decided they didn't want to use Gradle. And it's just logic. There's no architecture stuff. It's just like Java and like maybe log from Android. That's what comes in J2BJC. It's also command line friendly, Xcode not friendly. And there's a long explanation of that. So what we did is essentially make it more usable for developers. And then we took a bunch of stuff from the Android open source framework. So SQLite database and the threading stack. So Looper and Handler and message queue, shared preferences, local files, context, but just, you know, anything that made sense in iOS. So, there's no service or content provider because it doesn't really make sense in that world.
Yeah.
And what we did and did not take is just, you know, over the years of experience building Android, to know what you're likely going to use in your project or is likely going to be in a library that you enjoy, you know, that you use. And the whole purpose really is below the UI, you know, they're really the same thing, you know, the same. They have threading, you know, main thread and a background thread. They have SQLite. They have local files, you know, networking, location. Like there's a, like these are basically the same platform with different method names. And we don't think that shared UI is a good way to go. It's very hard to build a consumer pleasing UI with a single code base. And then, you know, history is littered with, you know, the corpses of those attempts, right? But underneath the UI, it really is very viable to build the same architecture. And architecture is hard. So, for example, in this, we took the Android, the new architecture components, and we took those and made them work in iOS, including the RoomDB and, you know, view model. We're using RxJava. We're using Retrofit 2 and all that stuff. The purpose of which is you can use your MVVM or MVP architecture, and it's very easy to slice in native components from the native platform, and you can use the same tests and all this stuff to build the architecture once. So that's what we're working on.
Cool. So is this something that's out on GitHub right now? Is it in an alpha stage, beta stage, or how can I get my hands on the bits, or are folks listening, can they?
Absolutely. So we're in what we call technical preview, and we largely call it that because I don't want to support when people, you know, like, this isn't working. I'm like, yeah, I know. But it's different pieces are in different stages. J2OBJC is very stable. It's version 2.0.3. It's been around for years. We are rapidly approaching what I would say is more of a beta phase. We are signing the contracts. I really wish we had sorted this out before this meeting because it's a very interesting name. But we're going to have someone helping us out with our docs because that's not really what I do well. But we have a person that does a lot of docs, and they're going to be doing this. And the purpose is in the next few weeks, we're going to try to put out a version that is very usable. But right now, you can go get the Droidcon app, and you can build the full Droidcon app. You know, it's all open source. Everything's
so the Droidcon app that's running on my phone right now is from built with Doppel.
Yes, but you have an Android phone, right?
I do.
So the thing to keep in mind is one of the arguments is that the Android side is 100% Android native. There's no cross-platform stuff. Mm-hmm. So
you use that word.
What? Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm like, there's no badness in the Android side. And that's one of the big the benefits of this, right? The iOS app, which we did launch, is, yes, it is using Doppel to share all the architecture code, including the we re-architected the app to use Room and the view model and RxJava and Retrofit. And that is public. You can go clone it now and build it. You should give us to the end of the week to update the docs because, again, you know, running a conference is time-consuming. But that's where we're at. And all the tools are Apache. You know, we're trying to have obviously, and as React has recently reminded everybody, if you give people a license that is confusing, they're going to ask questions about why. So we didn't want any of that. It's just like everything's Apache, and obviously in the Android world, that's everyone's used to. So you can go play with it now. It's just we need better docs, and we're going to sort of smooth out the rough edges.
All right. Well, I think this is something we're, Kaushik, and I'm going to have to bring you back on the show with eventually when Doppel's a little more released, get the documentation out and everything, get a little more of a deeper dive into it. So we'll have to invite you back on the show. You're a very busy man today. I want to say thank you for taking a few moments to chat with us. If folks want to get a hold of you, what's the best way they can get a hold of you or your company or anything?
Well, you can email me, kevin@touchlab.co. If you're on the ASG Slack, you know, just reach out direct. I think that's probably the most straightforward way. Or Twitter, KP Galligan.
Well, Kevin, thank you for putting on this conference. It's a fantastic one. It's one I look forward to every year. I know everyone who comes here looks forward to it. Thanks again for having me and for having everyone else here.
All right. Well, thank you. It's really good to finally be on your show.
Definitely. Have a good one.
Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsor for this week, and that sponsor is BuddyBuild. Now remember, BuddyBuild is a mobile-optimized continuous integration and delivery platform that was built specifically to help you, the developer, engage your end users during the entire software development lifecycle. Check them out at fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild. Again, that's fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild. Thanks again.
That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode. Thank you.